This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. I don't know about you, but I'm really, really excited that we're already knee-deep in mud as we get ready for another race for governor. Now, Tom Foley barely lost to Governor Daniel Malloy 3 years ago. He spent the last few years forming a think tank and staying in the public spotlight, so it's no surprise he would eventually roll out his own campaign, or at least an exploratory committee for that campaign. That's what he did in a press conference and then later on WFSB's Face the State. The problem for Foley, he didn't use the occasion to really kick off a big new jobs plan or a campaign message. Instead, he made a series of pretty serious claims about Governor Malloy's ethics. Now, his proof?
There are things that are believed, so they're a problem whether they're true or not. But it seems that there's some substance to them, but I can't confirm that they're true.
Oh, boy. Now, today it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, where we'll tackle this and other stories, like the convicted prostitute who got hired by the state and then got caught stealing money. Oh, boy, again. Our guests today are Colin McEnroe, as always, the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show. Welcome, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
Good morning.
And back on our show for the first time in a while, and very good to see him, Dennis House, anchor and host of WFSB's Face the State. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning to you, John.
So, well, let's get into the newest news on this Foley story first. We were going to start with his interview with you, Dennis, but I want to talk with Mark about an interview that he gave to you, I guess just yesterday. What's the latest in what Tom Foley is talking about around proof of allegations against Governor Malloy?
Well, at 5 o'clock yesterday, I was talking to Mr. Foley by phone, and I was trying to pin him down on his approach to his quote-unquote reliable sources, whom he says has given him information about various ethical misdeeds. The most explosive, I would say, is the allegation that Dan Malloy took money, worked for, somehow he got cash from Dan Esty while Malloy was running for governor, and then he rewarded Esty with a job. That's new. That's pretty explosive stuff. Foley indicated to me that he was stung and hurt by the blowback he's been getting since his first announcement and then his appearance on Dennis House's show on FSB for making these allegations without really showing us the goods. And he said, why should I be held to a different standard? I'm working by the same rules as journalists. I have two sources. So I said, fine, I'm going to ask you the same questions any editor has asked me when I've said I have, you know, some sources who are making these allegations. And the first of those questions, the most basic of those questions is, how do your sources, how are they in a position to know what they're telling you? And Mr. Foley's initial answer was he repeated my question, and then there was kind of a pause, and then he acknowledged he never asked. So he says he has two sources. He says he is acting by the same standards the journalist asked, but he never asked them, how do you know?
Which is the sort of thing that we tend to do in our business an awful lot. Dennis House, you spent time with him on your show when he was essentially rolling out his brand new campaign. But as I suggested in the intro, we really had to focus. You had to focus on these allegations. What did he say to you, and what was your reaction to his answers when you were asking him about the evidence that maybe he doesn't have?
Well, Tom Foley was originally booked for this week. And after he announced he was going to start this exploratory campaign, I called him or emailed him and said, why don't you come on, you know, the next show we have, which was last Thursday. He said, let me get back to you. After that announcement, he did call back and said, let's come on. And we discussed briefly that he said he wanted to make some news. And the day of the taping, he said that he was going to, you know, get into some of the allegations. And I try not to get too much information out of the guests before we have them on like you do, because we want the information to be fresh when they're talking about it. And as he said it, looking back on it, I probably should have asked some more questions. But you're right. It doesn't pass the journalistic sniff test. We wouldn't have gone on the air with these allegations. And some of them I had heard little rumors about before. A couple of them I was surprised at. And he basically said if it's because these are believed, they're damaging to the governor. But they're believed by whom? Because I don't think they're widespread across the state. Maybe around the Capitol people have heard little bits and pieces.
But and it's one of these things, Colin, and you addressed this in a column over the weekend too, this idea that if something is believed to be true, then it is fodder for a campaign. is a standard that I suppose we've sort of heard before out of politicians, but this is unusual on many different levels, including the timing and including just the lack of evidence that we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly made some news, as Dennis said. I'm not sure exactly what news he made. I mean, probably to a certain number of people. I mean, first of all, he probably has somebody advising him right now, telling him this is a good thing to do. And what people will remember are the, you know, sketchy allegations. They won't maybe remember how sketchy they are, and you'll dominate a news cycle for a while with some negative stuff about Malloy. But I'm not sure that that's how it's playing out for him. And it, you know, I don't know. Every week, I file a basically satirical column for the Hartford Current, and my editor, Peter Pock, always writes back to me and says, they're making it too easy for you. And I don't know what he would say about this. I mean, it really is making it way, way too easy for us.
Well, let's go through some of these allegations. You addressed one of them already, but let's listen to Tom Foley on Dennis's show. This is talking about the allegations around Dan Esty, now the DEEP commissioner. Let's listen.
It's believed, or I've heard a lot of people believe, that his consulting firm, Esty Environmental Partners, or some entity that he controls, was compensating Dan Malloy.
As a candidate?
Well, not as a candidate, but either with consulting fees or compensation or something of value. And it was not, in fact, a contribution, so which is a problem in itself. And so as soon as Governor Malloy is elected, he's made a commissioner of DEP.
Okay, so Mark Pazniokas, this is one of the threads that you followed up on a little bit, and you asked Tom Foley about one piece of evidence you were trying to track down around this. So maybe you can talk that through in the story that you had in this morning.
Well, I assumed that what Tom Foley had heard was something that had a bit of truth to it. Dan Malloy was employed by a company called Class Green Partners. They are a municipal kind of finance group in New York, after he left the mayor's office in Stamford at the end of 2009. And in fact, if you look at Governor Malloy's financial disclosure statement, he discloses that was his sole income in calendar year 2010. And there is a distant Esty connection to that company, in that Andrew Shapiro, one of the partners, was on an advisory board at Yale, an advisory board to some kind of environmental center that Esty was running. But Esty said, I had never heard of this company. I had nothing to do with the introduction. And to boot, Mr. Foley told me yesterday, that's not what I'm talking about. That's not the Esty thing. So I guess we can set that one aside. So he.
Well, what is he talking about? Come on, tell us.
Well, and
how hard would this be?
And he's asking for Malloy's tax returns from 2006 to 2010. So there's sort of there's a logic question to ask. Why in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, or even 2010 would Dan Esty, who is this hugely successful Yale author and consultant, he had a very, very lucrative consulting business. Why would he be plying Dan Malloy with income in the hopes that A, Malloy would be elected governor? And remember, in 2006, no. Even into 2010, Dan Malloy was not a front runner even to win the Democratic nomination. So it really doesn't make sense. Now,
why would he be plying him so he could get this job at the DEP where he'd take a massive pay cut from the work that he was doing consulting and writing books?
And Foley, I asked Foley, I said, do you believe Dan Esty is qualified to be commissioner? Yes, absolutely. Do you believe Dan Esty took a massive pay cut to take this job? Yes, absolutely. So what's the motive?
Well, I mean, to be fair, Dan Esty really did want a job in the public sector, and he had nosed around in New York before this. And, I mean, he was so eager to get a kind of commissioner-level job for his own reasons that have nothing to do with financial gain, obviously. I mean, he would have taken one in the Assad administration if that was the only one he could find. But I mean, he really did want that. But I just – still, there's no – connectability to these dots. There's no there there. And really, Foley has now reduced this to some kind of cheap nightclub mentalist act where, you know, Paz is supposed to guess which thing it is. No, you didn't guess it right that time. It's something else, but I'm not telling you.
Well, and this is one of those things, Dennis, as you were confronted with this, because in this original press conference, he laid out what he said were these allegations, and there would be evidence to back this up. Have you ever really encountered something where when someone's brought on to make news to give the evidence, there's no evidence there?
Well, I wish I had a staff like Tim Russert used to have, where when someone says something, they're researching it right there, and they get in your earpiece and say, what he said is just false. And it's difficult to do that. You know, in the course of Faces Day, we have a very small staff, and when he said these things, some of them I'd never heard before. So obviously we couldn't, you know, confirm.
But I thought everyone was talking about these things, Dennis. That was the point. You'd never heard them? Anyway,
well,
please continue.
You know, around the Capitol Circle, I think some people had heard inklings of certain things, but certainly they were not widespread, at least not to my knowledge. But, you know, Colin said earlier he probably did this on the advice of an advisor, but I think he did it all by himself, because what advisor would tell him to go forward with this? None of us here have worked for a campaign, but certainly we've reported on enough of them to – we could advise a candidate if we had to. And my advice would have been investigate it first. Make sure you have every, you know, T crossed and I dotted before you go public with this.
You got to remember two things at this point. Even though he was the nominee in 2010, only 40-something percent of Connecticut residents really know enough about him to have an opinion. So – Tom Foley the other day really had to begin the business of reintroducing himself to Connecticut. That's point one. Point two, the guy he's trying to unseat, as of June, his reelect number was 44%. A majority of Connecticut residents believe he is mishandling the economy, mishandling taxes, mishandling the budget. This ain't a bad place to start, mm-hmm. simply by saying, this is who I am, this is what I believe, and by the way, I think the other guy is doing a bad job.
Well, and I think another point to this, Colin, is whereas a lot of people in the state still aren't familiar enough maybe with Tom Foley to say, I want him to be our next governor, when you look at Tom Foley, given the fact that he came so close to almost being elected last time, that he's expended quite some money to run for governor once and maybe almost again, and in comparison to the other people who might be in the race for the GOP nod, people who are not well-known statewide. I mean, Tom Foley's sitting in a pretty good position before this press conference and before this appearance on Face the State.
Yeah, kind of. Although my biggest concern over the last few days is that John McKinney is going to pull a hamstring doing a happy dance. you know, I actually think that the Democrats don't want to run against McKinney, and they'd rather run against Foley.
And again, this is John McKinney, the senator from Fairfield County, again, who has gotten into the race, as well as Mark Boughton and a few others.
In their more honest moments, they basically have suggested that that's the case, that Foley, because of the kind of performance he gave on Dennis's show, because this isn't good campaigning. You know, it may help him temporarily dominate a news cycle. It may help him kind of get, as Paz is suggesting, back, get some name recognition. But it's really not good campaigning. It's not effective. It may ultimately inoculate Dan Malloy against the kinds of charges that Foley is trying to make. You know, typically, if somebody's going to go at you this way, you want it early in the cycle. Now, usually when we say early in the cycle, we mean May of the election year. We don't mean September of the pre-election year. But this, you know, this gives Malloy a lot of time to harden himself off. If there was any substance to any of this, he would have a lot of time anyway to harden himself off and deal with it.
We're in the wheelhouse today, and we're talking about the news of the week. We're spending a lot of time talking about Tom Foley's early run for governor and some of the accusations he's made against Governor Malloy. We're talking with Colin McEnroe and Dennis House and Mark Pazniokas, and with you at 860-275-7266. Ben's in Stonington. Hi, Ben.
Hey, John, Colin, everybody. You know, I can see very clearly that there's some very highly paid consultant from East Buck Tussle, Texas, or someplace giving Mr. Foley advice on this. This is just ridiculous. It's a waste of his time. There's a lot of ways you can get in the paper, and there's other ways that I could suggest to Mr. Foley that are even a little bit more outrageous. He needs to sit down and carefully describe to a voter why, if he wins, they're going to get a job. That's what needs to happen on a day-by-day basis, basic blocking and tackling running campaigns. And I just don't understand why the Republicans don't stick to that. The current governor has not done a good job. I I wish he did. I think he's a fine man. He's got an incredible story about what he's overcome. But we are, you know, 48, 49, 50th in all sorts of criteria. There's no reason this state shouldn't be doing much better than it is. And if Mr. Foley's going to think he's going to win by, you know, pulling out some sort of aluminum foil on his hat and beaming down crazy ideas about Dan Foley in some, you know, garage getting payments, that's not going to win.
Ben, thank you very much for your phone call. And Dennis House?
You know, to touch on what Pat said, Tom Foley has a pretty good foundation for a campaign if you look at the economic numbers. That should be your argument. Why muddy the waters with these other allegations, particularly at this stage in the game? Because what's the worst case scenario? Some of it is true and the governor decides not to run again? Don't you want to run against this governor if you're Tom Foley?
Well, if you want to go negative, wheel John Linder in with a hockey mask on his face on a gurney, you know, and unstrap him and say, John, just tell us what you know. I mean, there's plenty of stuff that Linder and other reporters in the state, I don't mean to make him the sole focus of this, have uncovered about things that go on in the Malloy administration that are nose-wrinkling in nature. They don't have to do very much with Malloy's personal conduct, but they do have to do with bad government practices and conflicts of interest and stuff like that.
Well, and I'll just say maybe another tactical piece of this, and this has been alluded to, is that Tom Foley, in doing this, wants to do something that we all know can sometimes happen with our governor, is that he will react negatively towards someone trying to get under his skin. And you wrote a piece, Mark, that I thought was kind of interesting, that there's this new kind of laid-back surfer zen Dan Malloy who seems to just ride all this stuff in a very different way. Maybe it's his advice. Maybe it's just he's been in the job for a while. But it is a sort of different way that he's tackling this.
He's listening to Jack Johnson a lot now.
He's listening to Jack Johnson on the beach. Yeah.
What Dan Malloy is doing is perfectly conventional politics. You don't engage with your opponent at this point. The reason I wrote that story in Dan Malloy, it was news. It was man bites dog. It was governor does not react. Because, yes, he can be thin-skinned. He can go off on reporters at press conferences, sometimes with comic effect. But the other thing you got to remember about Governor Malloy is, yes, he can be short-tempered, thin-skinned. He also can be incredibly disciplined in a campaign setting, and he says the campaign hasn't begun. He says he's not yet a candidate. Bull. He is acting as he is being advised to act. It's smart politics. He smiles when Tom Foley says his job numbers are phony. He shrugs when Tom Foley impugns his integrity, and he will not engage. He lets other people do that, which, by the way, was the advice that John Rowland on the radio the other day, I'm told, gave Tom Foley, which is politics 101. The candidate doesn't get personal. You let other people do that.
And, Pat, I thought it was also interesting. I mean, the other interesting silence here was Roy Ocio Grosso, as he's known on Face the State. Roy Ocio Grosso's Twitter feed kind of went dead. Now, Roy Ocio Grosso, who's been sort of the eminence grease behind Dan Malloy and who was every bit as short-fused as Dan Malloy can be, also pulled himself out of this. He was mentioned by Foley as one of the sort of possible avenues of investigation, but he's been very quiet, too. And I think this has been smart strategy, you know, pull all the hotheads into the corner, let Tom Foley have center stage as the guy who's some kind of fusion of Fox Mulder and Travis Bickle, kind of let him kind of do that whole thing and get out of his way while that's happening.
Which is another basic rule of politics. When the other guy is floundering, don't go near him.
Well, let's actually hear what Tom Foley told Dennis House about Roy Ocio Grosso, one of the many claims that he was making on Dennis's show.
Earlier this year, Roy Ocio Grosso left the administration, went back to his political consulting firm, Global Strategies Group, and very recently, they're awarded a very significant contract to handle, I believe, communications and PR for the Health Exchange for the state, which is a quasi-government entity, but their website is ct.gov, so it's clearly a government entity. Totally improper, if this is the case of what happened to me, that somebody leaves the administration and turns around and within a very short period of time, the company that he's a partner in receives a lucrative government contract.
So how unusual is something like this, Paz? Somebody gets a government contract who's a friend of the governor.
I mean, you can say that's as old as politics. I mean, there's a couple of things about this. This is, by the way, Tom Foley was not the one who broke this news. it's a matter of public record. It's been a matter of public record that Ocker Grosso's firm, Global Strategy, has this contract. One of the ways we know this is part of that contract is to call reporters and talk to us about health care. So there's that. Now, there were three firms who bid on this contract. One of the three firms did not submit a fee schedule, which I would think put them at something of a disadvantage. So it came down to two companies. Ocker Grosso's company was selected. Now, I will say in defense of Tom Foley, phrased another way, this is a perfectly legitimate thing to talk about. You know, the friend of the governor ending up with a contract, even if it was done according to Hoyle. It's perfectly legitimate, in my opinion, to say, doesn't this possibly cause people to have a lack of confidence in their government? Again, fair game. But wrapping it up in this big package of saying that there's corruption here, he's totally missed his opportunity to make that point, I believe.
And that's really the point in watching this interview, Dennis. It's a lot of it's in the phrasing. A lot of these same mm-hmm. things packaged in a slightly different way seem to be telling a narrative story as opposed to a story that is supposed to be backed up with facts.
And as Colin said, I was surprised that Roy was quiet about it. He hasn't said a single word about it. They sent Tanya Meck out, yeah. I believe, the next day.
From Global, yeah.
Well, I didn't let Roy go on that. I mean, he said, I'm not commenting, but please don't say I refuse to comment. And I said, Roy, that ain't the way it works. You're named. I said, I want to know your response. You can either tell me something or I say you won't comment. And then he did comment.
This reminds me a little bit of 2002, and perhaps the governor's taking a page out of the Roland playbook. John Roland, as I recall, did not announce his plans for re-election until late in the spring that year. And Bill Curry was attacking him left and right, and they'd say a little something here and there, but they just let him go at it. And by the time the spring rolled around, I mean, Roland was in a different situation. The economy was humming along, and it was widely assumed he'd be re-elected fairly early. But he waited late in the game to get into the race.
Yep.
One of the things that's most interesting to me out of all this is the lessons in journalism that we seem to be learning from Roy Ocker Grosso and Tom Foley, and maybe we should have them over to a class at CCSU sometime.
I learn every day.
Journalism classes. We're going to take a break. When we come back here in the Wheelhouse, we'll continue our conversation about state politics, about the run for governor. Yes, we've already kicked that off. We're also going to find out about a really interesting scandal at the DSS and also talk about maybe guns being back in the national conversation. We'd like you to join the conversation. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We're in the Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. And today in The Wheelhouse, Colin McEnroe, the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show, is with us as always. Colin, what's coming up on your show this afternoon?
We're going to talk to Eric Deggans. He's the author of a book called Race Baiter, about sort of the role that media plays in ginning up racial tensions. He's also the brand new TV critic for NPR.
Yeah, I just got hired by NPR. That'll be an interesting conversation this afternoon at 1 on The Colin McEnroe Show. Dennis House is here from WFSB's Face the State. He's a news anchor and reporter there. And, of course, he conducted this Tom Foley interview that we've been talking about quite a bit today. We'll take more of your calls about it at 860-275-7266 in a moment. And Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, is here. Just closing out on some of this Foley news, one of the things that I think was interesting in this conversation that you've had and this conversation we've been having over the course of the last week about what's proper in government and some of the ethical considerations that Tom Foley seems to be raising is you know, how somebody gets a job after being close to a political candidate. And you asked him about his own experience in this world.
Yes, I asked Tom Foley, well, what's your standard? Is it improper always to be given a job after you've done something of value for the elected official? Say, raise a boatload of money. And, of course, in Mr. Foley's case, he was a major fundraiser for George W. Bush. He was rewarded with the ambassadorship to Ireland. And Mr. Foley said, no, this is completely different than what I'm alleging. You know, so it's going to be for the voters to decide if there's a little bit of hypocrisy there or if that is truly different because there's a long tradition in that kind of thing.
Is it different, Colin?
Well, I mean, I think this is a set of questions that, Tom Foley's going to have to deal with a lot more. And I assume one of the places he'll wind up dealing with him is tomorrow and where we
live. Tomorrow he'll be on the program here.
One of the things he's had a lot of trouble doing is separating himself in any significant way from the Roland administration in his capacity. He was a little bit of a rainmaker for Roland, too. He wound up being appointed co-chair of a task force on divorce and custody. His qualification for that was he was a very unhappy with his own divorce process and custody process, which, as we know, occasionally resulted in traffic problems. But, you have things like that. You have his role with the Coalition Provisional Authority, the rebuilding entity of Iraq, where, once again, with dubious qualifications, he went over there. Of course, Iraq is totally rebuilt now, so that's great. I think these are all questions that he's going to need to talk about. And I think in the context of Connecticut, he really does need to talk about Roland. 4 years ago, you asked him a pointed question about the Roland administration. He had a hard time even sort of summoning his voice to say that they'd done anything wrong. And we know this was just a sewer of log rolling and no-bid contracts going to cronies and stuff like that.
Well, Dennis, I just want to ask you quickly, but before we move on to another topic, you know, you do a lot of these interviews, and heading into another gubernatorial campaign in all of the elections that we've got coming up in 2014, you've got to make an awful lot of decisions about putting these folks on television and speaking with them at length about a variety of subjects. And maybe you can talk about how you're making decisions about asking them about all this stuff that we're talking about today. Allegations and past behavior and things that are essentially about personality and political mudslinging versus actually getting a chance to ask about what will you do to create jobs. It's a delicate balance. I try to do the same thing. How do you handle that?
Well, we try to be fair with time, equal time for all the candidates. In this stage of the game, they come on for about 8 to 10 minutes, sometimes a little bit longer. In Mr. Foley's case, he went on a little bit longer, and that was fine. And there are some issues we might want to deal with later in the campaign, maybe not bring them up right now because the campaign's in a different phase. Number one, how they're going to raise money right now, why they're running, things like that. We tend to get into some of the bigger issues a little bit later in the campaign as it starts to roll along. In this case, Mr. Foley's, you know, interview was completely different because he brought up all these issues, which he believes is going to really help him with the Republican base, because I know that one of his supporters sent me a fundraising letter last night that he mentioned the face of state appearance. He said, we need to investigate these claims. Please help me, yada, 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 asking for money.
I think it's only fair you do something for him, Dennis, because he gave you a great Sunday last week. I mean, I have to say, in the Sunday morning, there were people texting one another. Word had kind of gotten out, and it was, you got to watch Face the State this morning. So not that we don't anyway, automatically. But,
well, normally we put out more information on it on a Thursday or Friday to get people to watch. But in this case, we decided to embargo it because the Crocodile Club was the next day. And we thought, well, if we say everything he's going to say tonight, no one's going to watch. They'll all be talking about it the next day. So we decided to wait. Our managers and I discussed it, and we decided to wait until the morning.
The Crocodile Club drives so many media. It's like the Bohemian Grove.
Well, he may have made Dennis's Sunday, but he ruined mine. I think it was the last great beach day on the Cape.
Well, I texted Mark, and I said, Mark, you may want to watch Face the State today. And he said, oh, there goes my Sunday. And
well, one other thing that came up over the course of these last couple of days is how Tom Foley's actually going to pay for this campaign. He suggested that he might take public financing paths. This is something that he wasn't too keen on, I think, last time around.
No, and there again, he had kind of the germ of an interesting strategy, how to put the rest of the Republican field off balance, wondering just what the hell this guy's going to do. But then when he was pressed, you know, on it and people noted he had self-funded last time, he said, you know, something kind of glib and said, you know, why should I spend my own money? Which I would argue completely undercut, you know, what he was going for. You know, if you're a wealthy guy from Greenwich or wherever, you don't want to be seen as that flippant about wealth. Why should I spend my own money? Particularly when you've attacked public financing in the past. So again, it raises the question of, does he really have a plan? How good is the advice he's getting? Does he know where he wants to go with this? Because I thought it was intriguing. And again, trust me, it threw the other Republicans off balance. And there is, you know, there are three other fairly significant candidates and a few more to boot. And it really made them wonder, what's this guy up to?
It does take away that argument that he's trying to buy the election if he does public financing.
Absolutely.
And he's always labeled as the Greenwich millionaire. We don't call Senator Blumenthal that, even though Blumenthal has a lot more money.
And His wife does, but yes. Well. But I thought it was an interesting tactic, and it was going to generate some conversation. But again, he undermined that by kind of giving this grumpy, why should I spend my own money?
Well, you know, I did notice a few months ago that his famous yacht, the Odalisque, was for sale. And what I don't know is it for sale because he wants to buy a bigger yacht, or is it for sale because, by his standards anyway, he actually needs a little bit more cash? I mean, who knows? I don't know what it's like to be that rich, or when it is that you feel like you don't have enough money, or that you can't afford to spend a lot of money on your run for governor. But it may actually be possible that he doesn't really feel quite as flush as he did 4 years ago.
You noticed this because you were shopping for yachts on Craigslist?
Yeah, I'm looking for something. This is not exactly what I'm looking for. I want one with a tennis court on it. But
what would the name of the yacht be? Colin.
No comment at this time.
No comment.
That's actually the name of my yacht. No comment at this time.
We're talking today in the wheelhouse with Mark Pasniokas, Dennis House, and Colin McEnroe. We're tackling some of the news of the week. If you want to hear more about Tom Foley, how about this? Tune in tomorrow. Tom Foley is here in our studio for the hour. You'll get the chance to ask him some questions as well at 860-275-7266. Let's move on to some other news of the week. News that, frankly, is a lot more depressing. News that has us all kind of shaking our heads once again. A shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, Colin. It raises, again, these questions that have kind of gone away about guns in America. There are a number of different kind of factors here that played out very, very quickly. And I'm wondering if you might be able to go through with us, because we've been waiting for so long, and we've talked about this on the show a number of times, for the final police report on Adam Lanza and the incident at Newtown. We've waited for almost a year now. But already within a week, well, a few days, we've heard seemingly more things about the mental state of this shooter, about his access to the Navy Yard. We know a lot more information, but there's a very different conversation happening around it. How does all this strike you?
Well, I think the questions about the police report and the attendant issues, sort of freedom of information related issues about, you know, what we can and can't have access to, have become precisely that. It's a conversation about government best practices, about freedom of information. I think it's less about gun control and more about that here in the state of Connecticut. Now, what's going on, obviously, at the national level? First of all, my heart goes out not only to the people connected to the Naval Yard shooting, but the people in Newtown who are having to sort of relive all this,
Exactly.
I mean, it just brings it all back for them. In terms of the politics of it, I think the politics of it at the national level are essentially unchanged. I think the wisdom, anyway, is if Newtown didn't do it, this is not going to do it. In the middle of all that, we saw in Colorado, and this is a very small sampling size, but a couple of state senators basically losing their seats for having voted for Colorado's gun control measure. That may not be meaningful, but politicians look around for anything that can help them take the temperature of the electorate. That probably would militate against reviving background checks or any of the kind of bills that would seem to make sense in the wake of something like this.
Of the two recent events, I think the biggest impact on the gun control debate is the Colorado recall election. I think politicians followed that very closely. The lesson is, gun owners, gun rights advocates are much more passionate. They know how to mobilize than people are in reaction to these horrible tragedies in Newtown and now at the Washington Navy Yard. I think there's a growing body of evidence that that's the case. And as Colin just said, if the deaths of 20 children and 6 educators isn't going to move the needle, I'm not sure what is. You know, even a shooting at a Navy Yard within walking distance of the U.S. Capitol.
It's a shooting at a Navy Yard within the walking distance of the Capitol, but it's also one, Dennis, in which we seem to know a lot more about the mental state of this gunman than we even still know now about Adam Lanza. With the police report still under seal, we don't know much about Adam Lanza, but we've had a year-long almost conversation about mental health and mental health reform. It seems pretty clear as though the guy who did this shooting had some serious emotional and or psychological problems, and we know that already. Does it get us back into this conversation about mental health really being the issue for some people and not guns?
Well, there certainly needs to be more money spent on mental health screening. You can go and you can buy something and they can run your credit check instantly and things like that. You can find out so much about people. Yet you can't find out whether they're mentally unstable and they're allowed to have a gun. And I grew up in a little suburb outside of Boston. I never saw a gun. The first time I ever heard one go off, I was in New Haven covering a shooting. And it just you know, if we didn't have guns, obviously these things wouldn't happen. But I understand the argument. We just went to visit some relatives out in Ohio. They all have guns.
Dennis and I grew up in the same suburb, and it's quite clear that Dennis did not go to the same bars I went to.
Well, Mark was from the gun-toting Pazniokas family across town on the other side of the tracks. We didn't have one.
Yeah. He's like, it's very, very different communities.
Colin? Just a quick thing. You know, one of the ways that this kind of gets bifurcated is you have people talking about background checks and sort of other kinds of gun control, background checks connected to mental health. And you have other people saying, no, let's just talk about mental health.
Yes.
And Dick Blumenthal kind of came forward, not saying let's only talk about mental health, but he's come forward recently, his post-Navy Yard shooting, saying let's get the mental health component right. And I'm all for that, but I do believe that it's not enough. And I go back to the Matthew Beck lottery shooting case. I happen to know the clinician who was treating Matthew Beck at the time. He's one of the most talented, gifted, instinctual clinicians. I don't know him well, but that's my sense of who he was. He just missed it. You know, you can have somebody getting good mental health care and still miss, you know, what's really happening there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you really do have to – it's not enough to have good mental health care. It's great to have good mental health care, have good clinical programs, but you got to get the gun part of it right too.
Paz, did you want to jump in?
Well, I was just going to say one difference between the Lanza situation and the Washington Navy Yard is, as far as the information that's out there, is the Washington Navy Yard shooter had intersected with the police several times. There was several public records about those arrests, about concerns that were raised, as opposed to a 17-year-old student whom we now believe was laboring under some mental illness. That was all.
We're talking with Mark Pazniokas, Dennis House, and Colin McEnroe. We're in the wheelhouse. We're tackling some of the news of the week. When we come back, we'll bring in Ariel Levin Becker from the Connecticut Mirror to talk about the rollout of the state's health exchanges and talk about some other stories from the DSS, which she covers. And we'll try to figure out what this name means. Does anybody know the name Sookie Handley? Does anybody know that? She's on Face the State this week with Dennis House. We'll learn more about who Sookie Handley is. We'll talk about the DSS, and we'll talk about Obamacare coming up next here on The Wheelhouse Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, as we've said before, Tom Foley, who has announced an exploratory committee to run for governor once again. He will be on our show to tackle some of the questions that we've been talking about today. You can join us with your own questions for Tom Foley coming up tomorrow here on Where We Live. Today, it's our regular Wednesday news roundtable called The Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. And Dennis House, the host of WFSB's Face the State, joins us as well. I want to bring into the conversation Ariel Levin Becker, who covers health and healthcare issues for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi again, Ariel. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well. There's a lot to talk about, actually, in some of the things that you cover. But let's start with the story, and I'd like you all guys all to jump in on this. We read the story in the Hartford Current that the DSS, the Department of Social Services, hired an employee named Sookie Handley. They didn't know that Sookie Handley had been convicted on prostitution, drug possession, and larceny charges. While she worked for the state, she stole more than $44,000 in benefits, which she admitted was due in part to an addiction to OxyContin. Really? This happened, Ariel?
Yes, apparently this did happen. She was hired by DSS in 2008. She was arrested in 2011 for fraud, for apparently stealing these benefits and convicted. She was given a suspended sentence. And the reason this has made news now is that the state auditors a couple of weeks ago issued a letter saying that when DSS found out about this fraud, they notified law enforcement. They told the chief state's attorney's office, but they didn't notify the state auditors. And so the state auditors were saying DSS is not reporting this to us in a timely manner.
So what is the DSS saying about this now? How are they handling this now that this is all sort of blown up, gotten in the newspapers, and people are talking about it?
What they've said is that their hiring procedures are a little bit different. Remember, she was hired about 5 years ago. And also that they did, in fact, report this information to the auditors. The auditors found out earlier this year when they started doing an audit of the department. But they said that they're going to work to try to get information to the auditors on a more timely basis in the future.
Yeah, we got some of the classic Larry Caffaro quotes out of this. Are you kidding me? Are people shocked at all about this, Paz, that this is the sort of thing that ends up happening in the state? Or, there's tens of thousands of people hired by the state. This is just, you know, every once in a while you're going to hire a convicted prostitute who, you know, steals $44,000.
I pass on that.
Is that a loaded question?
I mean, sure, people are shocked. You know, you hope that you don't have convicted prostitutes working in social services. You know, maybe economic development. You know, that could work, but
tourism,
yes.
And I just assumed, Colin, when I first read this, that they were talking about Sookie Stackhouse. You just did a show with the guy from True Blood yesterday. I completely missed this. I guess I misunderstood.
I know. Obviously, as Pat suggested, Sookie Handley may have much to offer the state of Connecticut, but maybe she was in the wrong job. On a kind of serious note, a couple of things here. First of all, I think if you were Tom Foley or John McKinney or somebody like that, you look at this and think, you know, public sector jobs are like more and more desirable. They are pearls of great price these days. In fact, to a degree that's alarming. You know, Michael Lewis in his coverage of the European meltdown sort of says, you know, one of the things that's bad in countries is when the public sector job is a lot better than the private sector job. So public sector jobs obviously should not be given away recklessly. It would be interesting to know, and it will be interesting to find out exactly how did she get this job? What was the process? Did anybody help her? Was there an intervention by a politician to kind of nudge things along? Who knows? That's kind of an interesting thing. The other way that I think this is sort of frameable is particularly the auditor component of it is, you know, the Malloy administration has demonstrated an open hostility to the notion of watchdog agencies. You know, I mean, they don't like it. They want to kneecap them, handicap them, move them to the back of the room, put them under their control, all that kind of stuff. This is sort of another case where, in fact, this is stuff that we, the public, need to know. It was known in 2011, but we didn't know it until now.
So one of the other things that you're obviously covering, Ariel, is just the state of the DSS right now. Over the course of the last year or so, we've heard a lot from Rod Bremby, who heads up that department, saying we're going to change this department. We're going to have new efficiencies. We're going to use technology, and we're going to institute a new system that will allow people to get their benefits a lot more quickly. You and others had reported on massive backlogs, people trying to get their benefits from the DSS. Now, this new system got rolled out. Is it doing any better than it did before?
It really depends on who you ask. I've talked to some people who think that at least at the moment it actually has been worse. What's changed is that documents that get sent to DSS get scanned into the department's computer system by a state contractor. And the idea is that will make it easier for people at DSS, if you call up and say, I need some help or I send in my file, what's going on with it, they can quickly access your information on the computer rather than having to dig for the paper file. The issue had been once this new system started that there was a growing backlog of getting the documents scanned into the department's computer. What DSS has said is that backlog is gone, although I've heard from people who say clients are still having problems getting information, calling up and finding that their documents are not there. And sort of the effect of not having those documents accessible to DSS workers means that in some cases people might send in their renewal forms and even if they send it in on time, their workers might not get it and might have trouble processing it by the time it's due.
I mean, a lot of the call by advocates who've been looking for change here is the problem at DSS in part is not the technology, it's that we don't have enough people to do the work. And it almost sounds as though in this major transformative process, Ariel, the same thing is happening. There aren't enough people being hired by DSS to do the work. What are they saying about that?
What DSS has said is that the problems that have happened so far with this, what they call the modernization, is not because they don't have enough workers. That initially the hang-up was that it was taking too long for the state contractor to scan documents into the system. They say now that's been taken care of. The contractor itself had quadrupled its workforce. But there have been a lot of complaints that calling into the DSS phone system, you wait a long time on hold. I talk to people who say they wait an hour or two on hold routinely. So obviously, if they had more people to answer the phones, that could potentially alleviate some of the problem. What Commissioner Bremby has said is that once the scanning situation is under control, the call volume, he thinks, will go down because you won't have people calling multiple times to find out whether their documents are there. So he says it's not an issue of not having enough staff. Obviously, there are advocates, some of whom have sued the department over this issue, who say it is.
Have they said whether anyone should have noticed what Sookie was doing? Or was this, like,
isn't that kind of axiomatic?
You know, like a check and balance system that maybe, you know, just fell apart?
You know, I don't know that answer.
I was just curious.
Well, I wonder in the range of all the things when we started our program talking about the fairly legitimate ways that Tom Foley or other Republicans could come after Governor Malloy and his administration. Do you think, Paz, that things like what Ariel's reporting on here, just backlogs of the DSS, essentially a social safety net that's costing a lot of money but doesn't necessarily help the people it's supposed to help in the way they need help, is that something that you think can actually make fodder for a campaign against Governor Malloy that sticks?
Are you suggesting that the way to win a Republican primary is to suggest that poor people are being ill-served by the state of Connecticut?
It's Connecticut. I mean, those
issues are more difficult. What were we talking about more? We were talking about Suki because you can – it's a, oh, wow, as opposed to the detailed stuff that Ariel was just sharing. It's fairly dry stuff. It's incredibly important. But it's you need examples, you need horror stories to say if an agency under Malloy is not performing, this is the result. That's how you run campaigns. That's how you get votes. You need good stories to make those points. You can't just say it's ineffective.
This is going to be difficult for Foley because I've heard that Tom Foley intervened to get Suki Handley her job. I don't know. I can't prove it, but people believe it.
Do you have two sources?
I feel as though this is an argument that maybe a different candidate can make. I mean, Mark Boughton can maybe say, look, I don't run Danbury this way. This is how I run Danbury. McKinney, with his knowledge of state government, can maybe make that argument. Foley, you know, his typical stance is one of antipathy towards the size of government, towards government employees. I don't see how he can run on let's not streamline Connecticut government so much that the DS those phones aren't getting answered.
Well, I think one last thing we want to get to in just the last little bit of time we have. This is another big thing that's rolling out. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out politically, but I think it's much more interesting to see how it actually works for people on the ground. October 1st, this new healthcare exchange opens up, Ariel, and you're doing a lot of reporting on it. NPR is doing a lot of reporting on it. Our Jeff Cohen is. We're trying to explain to people how this new health exchange is going to work. What can you tell us that's new about this, that we can understand about this healthcare exchange when it opens up and how it's going to help people who need insurance?
So the healthcare exchange in Connecticut is called Access Health. It's part of the federal health reform law. As of October 1st, people who are looking to buy insurance, so generally people who don't have insurance now, who buy it on their own or who work for small companies, they'll be able to go online and sort of search through different insurance plans. And for the most part, the plans will be pretty much the same offered by different carriers. So you'll be able to compare both the price and what doctors are covered. And some people who earn below a certain income level, it's actually going to be quite a lot of people in Connecticut, will actually get sort of federal subsidies to discount the price of their insurance. That coverage will take effect January 1st. So the expectation is that although people can begin shopping and if they want, they can buy their policy October 1st, probably the expectation is that most people will not actually buy it then because they're probably not going to want to pay 3 months early.
One of the things that we find fascinating is this kind of – it's almost like a get-out-the-vote campaign that Access Health CT, this healthcare exchange, is putting on. They're going out to all sorts of places and people – they're trying to get people signed up for this, Ariel, and just interesting watching this. It's almost like a voting campaign.
Yeah, they're really trying to make sure they reach people and let people know that they're out there. There's most national polling shows there's still a real lag in the number of people who know actually what's happening and what's going on. So they went out to beaches over the summer. They've been going to concerts to hand out information, community festivals, that sort of thing. And they're having a lot of meetings around the state for people who have questions.
Colin, we just have about 30 seconds left. I mean, do you think that there's anything to this as the state tries to go out and get people signed up for this new health care exchange? Obviously, Obamacare goes into effect. At the same time, there's still continued rumblings in Washington about defunding this entire program. I mean, is it possible to have something actually work while there's so much uncertainty about whether or not it will be here in a year or two?
I think, first of all, the phase-in problem is going to be full of painful moments. You know, this is going to be a difficult thing to achieve. And there's going to be moments where small businesses just sort of say, look, you know, we literally can't make this work. So and in the climate you're describing, it's going to be even harder. Just one quick thing here. You know, one of the targets I'm sure here with this effort, young men. Young men are the key to all this. Getting young men insured as part of the overall insurance pool is the key.
Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks.
Thanks also to Dennis House, the anchor and host of WFSB's Face the State. Always good to see you, Dennis.
Good to see you, John.
Thanks to Ariel Levin-Becker, who covers health and healthcare issues for the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Nice tie, Paz.
Thank you, and I think I'll listen tomorrow.
Tom Foley's on Where We Live Tomorrow.